The dream is what we all, you know, labor under in this country. The notion that what is happening in your cities, what is happening in our cities, the notion that where certain people live, how certain people live, the manner in which they live is somehow natural. That in this country where we have a wealth gap in which for every nickel of wealth that African-American families have, white families have a dollar, that is somehow natural and just the result of hard work. That our wealthy suburbs, even though this is changing a little bit, it was true when I was a child, our wealthy suburbs that ring our cities and our, you know, black inner city neighborhoods, which are characterized by incredible levels of violence and struggle, that is somehow natural. That there is no social policy behind that, that there has not been a policy of plunder in this country, of taking things from black people and giving them to other communities, that everything in this country was fairly gotten. That people who have things in this country got them justly, strictly through their hard work. That all bad things that have happened in this country's history happened a long time ago and are completely irrelevant. Yet all good things that have happened in this country's history, all things that we are proud of, are deeply relevant and should be brought up and invoked all the time, particularly when you're about to go to war with someone.
Right.
That's the dream. That's the dream. So it's okay to invoke democracy and your heritage of democracy when you want to go and invade another country. It is not at any point okay to point out that heritage of democracy is literally rooted in slavery and is rooted in the enslavement of black folks. That's never okay. That's the dream. Mm-hmm. It's a notion of complete innocence and thus immortality, godhead almost. It is a deeply inhumane construct. And if I'm being too, you know, abstract here, I can very much, you know, bring it down, you know, on a level. I think, for instance, we had, you know, this situation in South Carolina where, you know, everybody's seen the video, and a young girl was dragged,
right,
you know, out of the seat. And, you know, you would cut on the TV and people say, yes, but what did she do before then?
Right.
You know? And yet you have to believe if black people did not exist in a certain way in this country, if there was not this history of criminalizing black people in our heritage, that, you know, wouldn't even be a question. It's an entire set of underlying assumptions, you know, that structure us, and not just, you know, assumptions, but the notion that those assumptions are somehow just, that they're fair, that they're correct, that it's right to ask that, you know, as opposed to interrogating, you know, why a 300-plus you know, officer under any circumstances should flip a child over and drag that kid across the floor. Or why they're policing the schools in the first place. The acceptance of that is natural. And not policing everybody's schools, by the way, but policing certain schools. And the acceptance that's okay and somehow natural and not at all reflective of anything wrong that we've done. You know, I made this case in an abstract way in the case for reparations. And, you know, I really try to make it in the most visceral way I could in between the world and me. The core of this book is the notion that effectively, you know, there is no America as you know it without the physical plunder of black people, okay? You know, we have 250 years of enslavement in this country at the root of this country's history. Enslavement is not something that was done on the side. It is not a mistake. It is not a bump along the road. It is the road itself. Now, what do I mean by that? 1860, when this country goes to war, the 4 million enslaved black people in this country were worth $3.5 billion. They were the largest financial asset in this country. They were larger than all the productive capacity in terms of worth that this country put together. If you wanted in 1860 to find the largest population per capita of multimillionaires in this country, you would not go to New York, you would not go to Chicago, you would not come out here to San Francisco, you would go to the Mississippi River Valley. And there was a reason why you would go there, obviously. And that reason was that was where the most wealthiest, you know, where the greatest conglomerate of assets was, and that was enslaved black people. And folks who live in the North who like to look at this were not immune from that fact. 60% of our exports was cotton. They came through enslaved hands. There simply is no way to imagine America without that wealth. It's just not possible. Somebody had to be brought over here, enslaved and made to work the land. And outside of that are all sorts of social assumptions that come from that. By the time you get to 1860, you know, Southerners are not, you know, enslaving people with regret. They are claiming, you know, people like John C. Calhoun, who's a great statesman, considered a great statesman of his time from South Carolina, articulated enslavement as, quote, a positive good. It was a good thing to enslave black people. When we have secession in this country, folks argue that, in fact, it is the foundation of a great civilization. There are effects when you think about people like that. And after we had abolition in this country, after we had emancipation, the, you know, the 100 years that followed after that, you know, did not commence with a period of letting black people go on their merry way, but it commenced with more physical plunder. And what was behind that all the time was the taking of things from black people over and over and over again. And the thing I tried to get across in Between the World and Me is this is not merely an attack on the black spirit. At every step, it is a physical attack. Slavery is mechanized torture. That's what it is. You know, that's what it means to whip somebody, to torture people into work. That was an accepted form. Black people in this country have been free for 150 years. We were enslaved for 250 years. When you habituate yourself towards certain things, when you repeatedly tell yourself and tell your children, tell your grandchildren, tell your great-grandchildren that the bodies of these people are not worth the same amount of respect as our body, well, that has effects. That has effects. You might find yourself in 2015 seeing a child flipped over in a classroom and asking yourself, yes, but what did she do first? Because you don't have the same basic level of respect for her body, you see? And it's been inscribed in you, you know? And so, you know, Between the World and Me is really an attempt to sketch out the effects of that, you know? There's a line in the book, you know, where I, you know, I argue that destruction of black bodies in this country is tradition. It is heritage. You know, and when I say that, you know, people, you know, they sort of clutch their pearls and say, how dare you say that? But it's a statement of fact. I mean, what is enslavement? What is lynching? You know, I mean, and so if you do, you know, those sorts of things over, you know, a number of periods, if the majority, the vast majority of your history constitutes those sorts of acts against the African-American body, what is that but heritage? How is democracy heritage and that not heritage? We I think too often in this country get into a debate. Folks, you know, want to protest, for instance, the violence of the police, the violence of the agents of the state, which deserves special attention, by the way. And it deserves special attention because you pay the police to protect you. And when you pay somebody to protect you and then they harm you, that deserves special attention. It deserves special attention because, you know, unlike, you know, ordinary citizens in America, the police are empowered by the state to distribute lethal violence. That deserves special scrutiny. It deserves more scrutiny. You know, you cannot use the standard of, you know, just run-of-the-mill citizens when people are imbued by the state to kill. You have to use a higher standard for that. But even if we were using the same standard, the point is that the kind of violence you see from police that, you know, we're seeing, you know, on video increasingly in this era, and the kind of violence that, you know, I wrote about, you know, that I feared walking the streets in Baltimore as a child, actually comes from the same source. Behind all of that violence are policy decisions at every level. You know, people, you know, say these phrases like black on black crime or why, you know, you're killing yourselves, you're doing this. Yes, but why? Why are African-American communities more violent than other communities? And what I've tried to illuminate, you know, in you know, my journalism and, you know, to a lesser extent actually in this book, but mostly in my journalism, is that black communities were formed by policy. Mm-hmm. Again, they don't exist, magically. You know, again, just going back to this notion of the dream, you know, we have this notion that, you know, white people walked out to the suburbs, planted stakes, and the suburbs bloomed, and that was it. You know, and that black folks stayed in the inner city and started shooting themselves, and then all these problems came out of nowhere. But within that is no discussion of housing policy. You know, there's no discussion of the fact that, you know, we made decisions in the mid-20th century in this country to create a modern middle class, and we did that through government programs, through government housing programs, that we subsidized loans for Americans, all except one group of people. And that we left those that group of people, black people, pretty much, you know, to the devices of unscrupulous lenders and to make their own way. And this has been totally, totally forgotten and taken out of the conversation. African-American communities look the way they look because they were planned to look that way. It was made that way. That is not a conspiratorial statement. I mean, literally, I say this everywhere I talk. I mean, you can, you know, go to your, you know, your phone, I guess, if you want to, you know, put in the term redlining and enter Oakland or enter San Francisco or enter LA or enter any other major city in this country, and you will find maps in which, you know, that were drawn by government hands that said what investment would go where. It's not a mistake. And so here we come. You know, in the time I'm coming up, in the 1980s, in West Baltimore, and these communities which have been repeatedly plundered, these communities filled with black people who, from the moment they've gotten here, have been plundered. And there's a higher sense of, there's a sense of desperation. And there's a higher degree of violence in those communities, and people say, why? You know, and I just look back and say, why do you think? Right. I mean, what did you expect to happen? What was supposed to be the result of all of that policy? You know, so the notion that somehow the kind of violence committed by the police, you know, who we send into those neighborhoods because we don't want to invest in any other way, the police, the criminal justice system is our investment in those neighborhoods, and the kind of violence that you see, you know, when folks are desperate and folks don't have anything, and you have incredibly lax gun ownership laws as you do in this country, the idea that one should be surprised by that or look at that as, you know, two different phenomena is just, you know, I think absurd.
You know, with when I read the case for reparations, which I think was stated and laid out fine, I've talked to people who may not have necessarily read the essay, mm-hmm. but just heard the word reparations. Mm-hmm. It seems like that word brings fear or nervousness in this country. Somebody feels like if there's reparations for this group of people, then my group of people is going to be losing out on something.
Well, I mean, yeah, they will lose out. I mean, reparations they probably will cost money.
Right.
You know? So you probably will have to pay something. That's true. But we pay people all the time. We lose out all the time. You know? I mean, part of the condition of being black in this country is to lose out. So welcome to the club. But I mean, even... Put that aside. You know, most of the time the problem is... you are holding me responsible for something that I did not individually do. I didn't own any slaves. Let's, you know, take it even further. I didn't design the housing policy in this country. Why should I have to pay? And my answer to that is you should have to pay because the basic theory of American government is that you pay for things that you did not, that you are not personally responsible for. If you think about that, without that concept, government basically falls apart. So for instance, there are, I'm assuming, you know, highways out here in California that, you know, need upkeep. Mm-hmm. Some of my tax dollars might go to that. I can't say I'm never going to drive down those highways, so why should I have to pay?
Right.
I did not personally authorize the Iraq War. My tax dollars went to support it. There's just nothing, I don't have any say over that. I was not alive, for instance, during World War I, or World War II for that matter. And yet my tax dollars go to pay for pensions, you know, for veterans and the families of veterans, you know, for both of those wars. Why? I'm not personally responsible for that. So the question is not, you know, whether you're gonna, you know, pay for things that you did. I mean, if every taxpayer only has to, you know, get an itemized bill, the government falls apart, right? It's an argument for anarchy. There's always some amount of redistribution of wealth. I mean, that is part of the basic theory of government. The only question is this particular argument for redistribution just? That's really the only question. I mean, you know, I didn't do it is a ridiculous argument.
Right.
It can't be respected at all.
But one of the statements that comes up with that is, you know, you people need to do for self. You need to pick yourself up by the bootstraps.
Well, you do need to do for self. I mean, you
but
do.
But there's more to it.
Right. I mean, as you know, everybody should do for self.
Right.
I'm a fan of doing for self. I think it's a good thing. But that doesn't really answer the question. You know, I mean, we have government in this country. It exists. I mean, are you going to argue for the, you know, complete abolition of government? You know, should we now go to people who are over 65 and say, you know, you need to do for self. We're not going to pay your Social Security. You know, are we going to do that? You know, are we, you know, going to, you know, suspend the myriad, you know, of programs that we have in this country? Are we going to go to our homeowners and say to them, we will no longer give you a tax break, which is, you know, a subsidy, effectively. It really is. We will no longer give you a tax break because you need to do for self. Are we going to do that? Are we going to go to big businesses? You know, I don't know if it's here. Where's the Chargers? Are they moving to L.A.? I think they are. You know, are we going to say to these football teams that move and get their, you know, their stadiums completely subsidized, you need to do for self? No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. Everybody should do for self. I'm a fan of that. But we have government in this country.
Right.
You know, and so the only question is, what is a just and fair, you know, theory for how that government, you know, should be utilized? And you know, I think in terms of reparations, you know, it is a demonstrable fact of American history that black people in this country have been repeatedly, as a community, injured and plundered, and that they should be repaid for that. You know, it's fairly simple as far as I'm concerned.
But what does that look like to you? What does that look like to you?
You say what?
What does that look like to you, the reparations?
I have no idea. and I'm fine with having no idea. I mean, I have all sorts of spitball theories, like everybody got all sorts of spitball theories. I mean, it definitely looks like money. I'm pretty convinced that. I don't know if it's like, you know, for a generation or two, you know, folks don't have to pay for college. I don't know if it's, you know, literally a jobs program. You know, I know that there's certain people, for instance, in the case for reparations who I chronicle who are very much alive, who were directly discriminated against, who should get a check, period. I mean, that just seems to me, you know, pretty easy. But here's the thing. It's not like we ain't done reparations before. It's not like we don't have any practice at this. We do. We do. You know, very justly and very correctly, you know, we're in the Bay Area, and there was a Japanese-American community, you know, that was unjustly interred in this country, and very aggressively and very rightfully and righteously argued that they would do reparations. And we did it. We did it, as we should. You know, we had a commission that studied it, under the auspices of Congress, that studied the problem. You know, and then made a decision that these folks deserve reparations. It's not like we don't have practice with this. We've done it before. The only question is it just? You know, it's not, you know, well, I don't want to be in the business of reparations. It's not because you are in the business of reparations, by the way. You are. Mm-hmm. It's not a question of, well, I only want to be responsible for what I personally know. No, you're going to be responsible for things you didn't personally do. That's the basic theory of government. You know, the problem is convincing people to see what is right, you know, in front of their eyes. Because it's right there. It's not even, you know, it was hard to write that piece, but then it was not very hard at all. The evidence was just so overwhelming. I mean, it was not even difficult to deal with. You know, I'm just gonna say this to Tom Blue in the face. It's like if I as a human being spend the vast majority of my life, I'm 40 years old, if I, you know, and I've been an adult for, let's say, 22 years, if I spend, I don't know, 17 out of those 22 years doing something negative with my time, that has an effect on the rest of my life. It weighs me down. You know what I mean? It will be very, very difficult to go and do other things. You know, it'd be very, very difficult to stop doing that negative thing. It's no different with a country. You know, a country is an entity. And if that entity spends long periods of time telling itself that black people are preternaturally criminal, that black people are not human, that black people are not to be trusted, that black people are not to be considered citizens in the same way as other people, the natural result is that people like Prince Jones die. The natural result is that girl being flipped out of her chair and dragged across. It's just what's going to happen. And it will happen again, by the way. This will continue to happen. And there's nothing that really can be done in the short term, this year, next year, that will stop it. You will be seeing videos like that probably for the next 15 years. And the only thing that'll stop it is people will just get tired of showing it on TV. But the videos are the result of policy. They come from heritage. They don't come from something that was just done yesterday. If you spend your time telling yourself that this group of people, you know, is effectively, you know, an enemy amidst, you know, in your midst. If you have a situation where, you know, you have a president of the United States who has to stand before his country and pull out his birth certificate because half, and in some instances the majority of the opposition party, of one of two major parties in this country, does not believe he's a citizen. That's not a mistake. That's the weight of history. It's what has to happen. It's just the grim, ugly math. And there really, you know, just is no way around it. So, I mean, we can't tell, you know, who's going to get killed or, you know, or where or how. But those deaths are just going to happen. I mean, that's the reality of it.